Hello, welcome to the Tombstone Podcast, a podcast where we talk about our favorite games. My name is Devin.
Kevin.
Dominic.
And Zach.
And today we're going to have some really good episodes for you. This is going to be a two-parter. We're going to be talking about the Soulsborne series of games, which span all the way from Demon's Souls to the newest release of Sekiro. We don't really have much to say about a few of these games, but that's okay. We'll make do. We'll at least have something to say about all of them. But before we get started, what are some games you've been playing lately, or you're looking forward to playing in the future? What are some things that you're excited about? We'll start with you, Kevin.
Yeah, so it's actually kind of funny because recently I picked up Dark Souls 1 again. just kind of apropos of nothing, I was just like, yeah, I really want this.
Just in time, right?
Yeah, right?
Just in time. So I was actually about to install it today, and then I was like, but we're going to be talking about it. I can get my fix from just talking about it.
Didn't want to sell yourself out yet.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But I've been playing that, and I'm also, something I've been looking forward to is the game Astral Chain. That's my one thing that I'm looking forward to right now. It's like the end of this month it comes out. It's a new Platinum game. Very, very good indication of quality there.
What is it called?
Astral Chain.
Astral Chain. What kind of game is it going to be?
It's if you know any Platinum games, like it's most like Nier Automata, where it's like an action RPG sort of thing, where it's like got pretty deep combat, and it's going to be sort of, man, I don't know. There's investigation, and like it's this. I think it's open world. There's speculation that it's open world, I think.
Is it going to be kind of like an L.A. Noir style? Or
sort of. Like, it's
like,
mostly
when you say
fighting.
Like cops and investigation. Okay, so it's going to be like Sleeping Dogs. Is that the one that I'm thinking of? Where is that the one where you're a cop, or are you just a gang member?
That's where you're a gang member, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's mostly going to be combat. Like, if you've seen any gameplay from Nier Automata, very similar to that, except you are one character and you also control like a sort of, I guess, astral projection, where it gets the name. You control both characters at the same time, and there's all these like tandem attacks you can do. There's a chain between the two of you. You can wrap people in the chain. You can do combos between the two characters. It seems really interesting. It's a sort of a game idea that I had like forever ago, sort of controlling two characters at the same time, almost as though they're one. And I'm really interested in that game.
Yeah.
Sweet. Dominic.
Yeah. So I've actually, I picked up Mass Effect for the first time. And I'm already pretty hooked. And it was funny because I was like, man, playing this makes me want to go back and play KOTOR. And I was like, well, I don't. Yeah, and I was like, I couldn't place it. And it's like, it's the exact same guy. So like, they know their model, like their formula, right?
They made Anthem, and then look where they are now.
Oof, yeah.
Well, then they made Mass Effect 3, and then Andromeda, and then Anthem.
Yeah. I've also been playing Middle Earth Shadow of War. I played Shadow of Mordor, and I really loved it. And this one, it kind of feels like how Breath of the Wild 2 is. Like, they made enough content to where instead of just doing another expansion, they just made another game.
Breath
of the Wild 2, which they've announced. It's not out yet.
I'm like, it's not out. Like, what do you,
no, but
well,
like,
how do you know what Breath of the Wild 2 is going to be
well,
like?
The only thing that I know is that they've said, like, we were going to make another like expansion or like another DLC, but they're like, this is so much new story that we're just going to make a new game for it. So they're like keeping the same assets and all that. Something that I'm actually looking forward to, I'm really looking forward to Indivisible.
I looked at that. It looks really pretty.
It is so beautiful.
Hand animated, like hand drawn by artists. thousands and thousands of man hours into every animation.
I'm glad because like Cuphead was like the was that the first hand-drawn video game?
No, Skullgirls by the same people who made Indivisible.
They made
Skullgirls, like, and that's a hand-drawn 2D fighter.
I'm just so glad that like that's something that people want to do.
It's very niche.
It is
niche.
I can't imagine the time that goes into it and how much animation that is.
Yeah,
it's insane.
It's not like making a show where you know, like, these are the steps. This is like here's the cinematography we're going to use. With a video game, you have an infinite amount of interactions that you have to animate all these different interactions, and it's just interesting that companies out there that are taking on that endeavor.
The only other game that I know of that is like has a lot of super hand-drawn elements, or the only two, is like King's Quest, and I know Hollow Knight was a lot of hand-drawn stuff, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
Which that was absolutely beautiful. But there's that, and I think the only other one that I'm like kind of like itching for, it's already out, but I haven't played Nier Automata. I've always wanted to play it, but I haven't.
It is really good.
Yeah. But I guess the upcoming stuff, I mean, I'm ready for Destiny to come to Steam. I've been playing it already, but like I'm just ready for that. Like, I don't know. I'm just ready for it to go on Steam so I can have everything in my Steam files again.
Sweet.
But I mean, that's about it. Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Let's move on to Zach.
Yeah. So I've been playing a lot of Destiny and Borderlands 1. Just waiting for Borderlands 3 to come out. still don't know what system, if any, that I'm going to get Borderlands 3 on because of the whole PC Epic thing. But yeah, that's pretty much what I'm looking forward to. That and then the Destiny expansion shortly after that.
Yeah.
All right. So. I mean, I've been playing a lot of Apex Legends, which they just released their solo mode, and I'm terrible. I'm even worse at solo mode than I am with actually playing people, because it sucks that like I could put everyone to like 25% health, but I can't kill anyone because like they kill me right before I can. It's like if I could just hit one or two more bullets, I could win majority of my fights.
That's the difference.
It's just really frustrating. Yeah. Okay. So, introductions out of the way. So let's get into our topic of Soulsborne games. We'll just keep going down the list of them. This episode we'll cover Dark Souls. We'll cover Demon Souls, Dark Souls, Dark Souls 2, and Dark Souls 3. And then we'll split off into the next episode. We'll do Bloodborne and Sekiro. And I'd like to go ahead and start with Demon's Souls right now. I have my notes pulled up. I know that I don't think any of us have played Demon's Souls.
No, I don't think so.
I've watched speedruns of it, so I can see a lot of the things where it's like, oh, okay, I mean, that's just a total rip from Demon's Souls and brought into Dark Souls, which is totally fine because it's the same company that makes it. But anyways, we'll go on to it. As I said, like Demon's Souls is like the first game in the series of the Soulsborne, and it was made by FromSoft, and the publisher was Sony. So they released it in 2009. Do y'all know the Kingsfield games?
I personally don't know.
No.
Well, it's. From what I've read, I've never played them either, but from what I've read, it's Demon's Souls was kind of made as a spiritual successor, which you'll hear that a lot within this, a spiritual successor of the Kingsfield games. And it's interesting, whenever it was released, that Demon's Souls actually didn't see that well of, since From Software, so it had little success in Japan. Like they saw the difficulty and they're just like, you know, what the hell is this? I don't want to play this. But whenever they had a Western release, people fell in love with it. It exploded in the West. People saw the difficulty and they saw it as a return to older style games where things aren't just handed to you, and you know you're not handheld. You know there is a challenge. Like at any step of the way, you can die. You might die from, you know, even the most lowly enemies are a challenge. So there's some ways that this game just actually made it more difficult if you were bad at the game. If you died a lot, first of all, there's one of the main things in the Soulsborne games is that you have this currency, which are souls, and it is your currency to buy things, and it's also your experience points in order to level up. Well, if you die, you drop all of your souls, and you leave a little blood splatter, a little blood pool. And in order to recover yourself, you have to go back to where you died and pick up your souls. And also, there is the soul form, in which if you die, you go into soul form, and unless you recover yourself, you stay in soul form. And in soul form, you have reduced health. So you die, and then you yeah. have reduced health. So it's like the difficulty compounds itself.
Yeah, and it's kind of important to note that a lot of these decisions were made because the publisher, Sony, just kind of gave up on the game. It was viewed as a failure fairly early into production, and there was this kind of screw-it mentality of, let's just do whatever the heck we want, right? And so they made a lot of those unconventional decisions. Like you said, you die, you go into soul form, you have reduced health. There was another thing where phantoms would start showing up, like more enemies would show up the more you die. The game would legitimately get more difficult as you were worse.
We're bad.
It.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As you were bad.
It makes sense in the world of the game. It's this very relentless, ruthless world, and it makes sense in a storytelling sense, but it's very, very unconventional game design.
Yeah, and it's very just punishing. That's why it didn't do well in Japan, was because they got this game and they're just like, this is just difficulty for difficulty's sake.
Mm-hmm.
But whenever it came over to the Western world, it was seen as like, here is a beckoning back, you know, hearkening back to the days where, you know, playing Jekyll and Hyde or something that's just like, what is going, am I bad or is this game just
obtuse,
super difficult?
And,
yeah, yeah. So something else is that like the multiplayer that Demon's Souls introduced is a staple of most of the Soulsborne games. We'll talk about Sekiro when we get to it, because that's a little bit of an outlier as far as all these games go. But Demon's Souls introduced that asynchronous multiplayer where you're never really interacting with anyone, but you can all affect each other's worlds. You can leave little notes on the ground to kind of guide people and just kind of help people in that way. And it's just such an interesting idea that you don't see anywhere else. You don't see the Dark Souls style of multiplayer in any other game or a game that I can recall. Like, there's no other game where I can leave a note for someone saying trap ahead, you know, and either I'm screwing with them or that's another story. But and what's interesting is that the Souls mechanic was actually kept quite, like, again, like you said, Sony was kind of hands off about it because they didn't really care. So like, they kept the Souls mechanic away from Sony. Like, they didn't tell them that this is what we're doing. This is like the currency and the level up mechanics and losing them on death. Like, they didn't tell Sony that. Mm-hmm. And an interesting idea that would have made this game, what the hell? They originally had the idea of permadeath. But they were just like, no, that's way too much.
No one would have
scrapped it. They scrapped it really fast.
And like, on that note, there is in the game a very, very unique and very, very punishing thing. There is an attack of one of the bosses that literally de-levels you. It will level you down just from getting hit.
That's insane.
It's insane.
Yeah.
So some things that you'll see in Demon's Souls, if you ever go back and play it, you'll be really familiar with it if you play other games in the franchise, is the use of a hub world, is the use of somewhere that you go to, and really you see it more in Bloodborne and in Dark Souls 3 rather than Dark Souls 1 and 2. Dark Souls 1 and 2 kind of have a hub world, but it's a little bit differently. Mm-hmm. But in Demon's Souls, you had a hub world where you went and you had your level up NPC, which was also a unique thing where you had to go to a character and talk to them and they will level you up. So you have your level up NPC there, and then you have these warp points that take you to these different worlds. I think there's 5 different worlds in Demon's Souls that you had to go to and explore. Of course, the punishing death mechanics is something that's really unique to Demon's Souls and the Soulsborne franchise, as far as like when you die, it sucks. Like you just lose a lot of progress. And then another thing is like the amount of weapons that you get in these games is ridiculous. I feel like Dark Souls is a little bit less, but you just have so many different weapons, so many different power attacks, stances, a lot of different stats. Some of them scale differently. Weapon scaling is something that's really interesting in this game. Took me a while to figure it out in Dark Souls how it worked. And then, so another thing that's interesting to me is that this being a Japanese company that makes this is that they use mostly Western storytelling.
Yeah, and I think that's a large part of why it wasn't so successful in Japan, is very Western in aesthetic.
Exactly, like they use a lot of West, like you have knights and you have all these gargoyles and whatnot that are very, that they're in Western mythology and folklore, and you don't really see it a lot in Japanese, and it's just, it's interesting that a Japanese company would kind of take that as their storytelling vehicle.
Yeah, and it's pretty cool because like they have the raw elements of Western mythology, right? But they'll put that sort of Japanese spin on it where it's got like what's the term for a Japanese spirit? But they have those, and it has that Japanese twist on it where everything's kind of weird and bizarre, and every like entity has its own weird motivations and things, and it has a nice Japanese spin on these Western aesthetics.
But I think that in a lot of cases, I know specifically with Dark Souls, I think that they do stay more true to the more Western, even more so like European, like thematic approach. Like they do have those like Japanese, like, or like more like Eastern style, like twists, like different motivations and things like that. But at the same, I think that they do adhere a lot more to the idea of like Arthurian, like cyclical storytelling and other things like that. I can totally see why it would be less received
in other places. It's a very bizarre thing, and it's hard to get into, which is something we're probably going to discuss, but it's hard to get into for a lot of people, and I think that was kind of why the series had such a slow start.
So that's Demon's Souls. I know that none of us have really played it, so we don't really have any firsthand experience. But from what I've said, you can see a lot of this bleeds into the series as a whole.
Yeah. Yes.
So let's move on to Dark Souls, the first game in the Dark Souls series. I think it's one that I know me and Kevin and I, that's what we cut our teeth on. So it was. It released in 2011, so it was 2 years after Demon's Souls was released. And From Software switched publishers from Sony to Bandai Namco. Mm-hmm. And seeing as how they switch publishers, they can't use the intellectual property of Demon's Souls. They can't use those characters and designs from that game. But Miyazaki, Hidetaka Miyazaki, the kind of lead director of the games, basically wanted to make a sequel to it, couldn't really do that, so it just kind of changed, you know, just changed some ideas of it. But whenever it was released, it saw critical acclaim throughout, you know, plenty of different reviewers just loved the game. And then apparently in their design phase, their development phase, Miyazaki is said to have employed a quote-unquote guided freedom philosophy, where they kind of just gave ideas to designers, to art designers and game designers, and just gave ideas to them and see what they would do, and then refine them from that point, which I feel is like it's almost like here's some ideas out of a hat, and, you know, let's see what you can develop, and let's see if it's worth developing more. It's almost kind of like how I, like, here's a word salad that I made, and what can you do with this? I kind of like that idea, yeah, of just going with the flow, just seeing what's out there. Some notable changes that we can see from Demon's Souls. Again, like I mentioned, the hub area, instead of it being here you are, here's a central place where you level up, you have your merchants, you have all your NPCs that you talk to, well, not all of them, but like you have a good bit of NPCs that you talk to that are kind of pivotal to the story, and you might meet them down the road or whatever, and then to get to other places you have to warp there. Instead, Dark Souls, it's your hub area isn't really a hub area. It's almost like a crossroads.
Yeah, it's like a central location.
Yeah, where I think in the beginning there's three different paths you can go on. You can either go down to Anor Londo, you can go to the catacombs, or you can go to the Undead Burg. So there's like three different places you can go, and then from there, from those other places that you go, they each split off like two or three times to go to just different places. Another thing that was a pretty big change was the introduction of the Estus Flask, because in Demon's Souls, the way to heal is that you had herbs that you could farm and heal. So healing was, in Demon's Souls, it was more of like, it was almost like, I kind of think of it as almost like an inconvenient thing, because of how you can just go kill these certain enemies that drop these herbs for you to heal, and you can just farm them, and just farm them, farm them, until you get as much as you need, and then whenever you run out, just go back and farm them. I really like the Estus Flask introduction in Dark Souls, because you start off, you have five times you can use it. So there's five times you can heal, and it doesn't heal you fully. It heals you at the beginning, it heals you like maybe halfway. And then of course you level up.
Yeah.
Of course you level up and you level up your vitality. So then it's healing you less and less and less. And then another change was they took out the soul form, and they really just changed it to be a human and hollow form, which the human form gave you better resistances, better drop rates, but it allows you to be invaded, which was the same thing. It's almost the same thing as in Demon's Souls. In Demon's Souls, you have to be in human form in order to invade and engage in the multiplayer, whereas when you're in soul form, you can't. And the same thing in Dark Souls, human and hollow forms, except this time you don't lose half your health. You just become beef jerky and you can't summon people, and people can't invade your world. Those are kind of the background notes that I have. Let's go ahead and open up some discussion.
Mm. Oh yeah. I think, you know, the sort of with the hub being not really a hub anymore, it kind of introduces kind of the world design, right? Because it's kind of important to note that I think this is the only game in the series, correct me if I'm wrong, I think it's the only game in the series where you don't start with the ability to warp between bonfires. And
yeah,
this is
yeah.
only made possible by the world design, because like you said, you know, the Firelink Shrine is the central point of the whole game. You don't get the ability to warp until halfway through the game, when it legitimately takes you maybe 20-30 minutes to get to the other side of the world. That's when it introduces warping. But everything in the beginning half of the game is so interwoven and so connected that you can get from point A to point B in like 5 minutes. And I think that that speaks very well of the design, that they didn't need to do that. And I think as a result, it probably has the best world design, in my opinion, the best world design of the whole series.
Yeah, it definitely has really good world design. Obviously, because of development, like there's a rush in development towards the end stage. So you run into problems with Tomb of the Giants and Lost Izalith and the Demon Ruins, where it's just like
there are exceptions.
It feels like there's especially Lost Izalith. Lost Izalith is hands down the worst part of any Soulsborne game. It is the lowest part of any game. But it doesn't necessarily detract from the game. It's almost just like, oh, here's a shitty part of the game that I have to get through in order to continue on and complete the rest of this beautiful, rich game that, yes, it is really well interconnected. And I know a lot of people like to complain that once you get the Lord Vessel, which is the object that you need in order to warp, and also in order to get to the Kiln of the First Flame, which is the last part of the game, a lot of people complain that once you get that to that point in Orlando, then it becomes really linear.
Yeah, I can agree to that.
Mean,
it's like four lines.
It's four lines because it's a line straight through the catacombs to the Tomb of Giants, and like you go beat Nito. Then it's a line straight to Duke's Archives to go beat Seath. Then it's a line straight to the Abyss to go kill the Four Kings, and it's. Who am I thinking of? Who was the last person? Who else am I missing?
Lost Izalith.
Oh, Lost Izalith. And it's like a
How
beeline
could we
to Lost. Yeah, it's a beeline to Lost Izalith to go kill
Bed of Chaos.
Is it? Bed of Chaos, yeah. Which, let's talk about that boss. Fuck that boss. Holy shit, that is the. Again, Lost Izalith is the worst part of the game. And the culmination
With the
of
worst
it
boss.
Is the worst boss in the series. I don't know. I don't understand how, because you just have to cheese the boss. It's hard to have a strategy. It's hard to say, here I am beating the boss. Like in order to beat it, one, you can either do the speed run strat, which is like run straight up and do these pixel perfect throws of firebombs to destroy those two orbs and then go kill it, which is really cheap. Or if you try to actually fight it, you will have the most frustrating time in your life getting swept away into the fucking chasm.
And it's important to note, too, that it's the only boss that will remember the condition of the fight. Any other boss, you're fighting it, and if you die, it starts completely over. But if you manage to kill one orb and you come and you die and you come back, that orb's still dead. It's almost as though they knew it's terrible and hard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's talk about PvP in this game. So the way PvP works is that you're in human form and other people can invade your world. You can get an item called either a cracked red eye or a red eye orb, and it allows you to invade other people. This is like the most cheeky multiplayer, because holy shit, you can be exploring for like 30 minutes, be on your last Estus, and your equipment's about to break, and then someone invades you, and you can't use your bonfire to heal up, so someone just comes in and just wrecks shop and then leaves, and then you lose like 50,000, 100,000, 200,000 souls, and you're like,
mm-hmm.
I'm done playing for now.
Yeah.
that's when you take a very long break and maybe buy a new controller or two.
Yeah.
Sort of restock.
Like, the PvP is something I don't think I've ever invaded a world. However, being invaded, depending on the circumstance, can be really fun. Because if you're in these scenarios and you know, you've played this game like 5 times already, you know where everything is, that just throws a little wrinkle into your plan, and you just have to improv and figure it out. And on some of those points, even though I usually die because I'm usually ill-prepared, those are the parts I'll remember, is when I had to improv and go, okay, well, there's an invader now, and I have to make a beeline back to somewhere where I know I'm safe. I have these resources. I can fight this guy. It's very memorable. It's difficult. We can argue whether or not it's fair, but it is interesting at the very least.
Yeah. It's unique too, because you don't really, like we were saying with the whole series, you know, if I understand correctly, there are really no other games that have replicated it, if at all, well. So that like, you know, invasions and things like that, like, influence your game progression, and there's no way that you can plan for it. It's not like you sign up to go play Team Deathmatch, right? It's that, like, at any given moment, your whole game is totally influenced by something very much out of your control. And that's why that's why it could get very difficult.
It's one of the most exhilarating things, like whenever you're just fucking going through and then all of a sudden someone just invades you and just wrecks your whole world. And we'll talk about the stakes in the later games as well, because being in the two different states, Human and Hollow, again, there's not much difference in Dark Souls. Later on in the series, there's a pretty big difference in those two different states. And they're not called Human and Hollow in all of them. But we'll talk more about them as we get there. But let's talk a little bit about first time that you've played Dark Souls, Kevin.
Oh, yeah. So I actually wanted to kind of speak on, like, what a good personal memory was. And, you know, the first time playing through was very... I refused to look up anything. I had no idea what I was doing. And I thought it was just this wonderful, interesting experience, because it was this world of seemingly infinite possibilities. Like, I had no idea what was going to pop out of the corner. I had no idea what I was going to have to face. I've had several times where I walk through a fog wall and I just see this big old nasty. I'm like, oh, no. So I have a lot of Capra demon. That's the one. That's the exact one. You're like, oh, I'm in the middle of whatever, and I'm just going to walk through this fog wall, and then there's a Capra demon and two dogs, and you're like,
a gaping dragon, which looks way scarier.
I was prepared for gaping dragon. That,
yeah,
I could see that was a boss fight. Didn't know what it would be. That was a surprise in and of itself. But it was just this, like, wonderful time of not knowing everything. And even on subsequent playthroughs, second, third, fourth time, I was still finding out new stuff, background and all that. But the one moment that really, really stuck out to me was I was in the Great Hollow. It's the tree that goes down.
Yeah, the Great Hollow.
Yeah. And I was in the Great Hollow, and, you know, they have all the curse frogs in there, or whatever they're called. And I remember the Basilisk. That was the first time I'd ever gotten cursed in the Dark Souls games.
Yeah.
Period. I had no idea what it meant. They cursed me, I died, I woke up, and it said, you have been cursed, go to New Londo or get a purging stone. I had no idea what a purging stone was at the time, so I was like, well, gotta go to New Londo. So anyone who's played the game knows that New Londo has ghosts in it. And it was funny because I had actually gone there earlier in the game, realized I couldn't hit any of the ghosts, and left. Well, I came back cursed, right? And I didn't even think about it, but I was able to hit the ghosts all of a sudden.
Hmm.
And So I had this really like harrowing experience where if you're cursed, you have half of your life. And I was built tank, so life was my main resource. And I was sitting there and I was like very scared walking through the hallways where ghosts would just come out of the walls or out of the floor or attack you from the ceiling. And like I have very limited health, very limited resources. I'm genuinely terrified for the first time in years from a video game. And I get all the way through New Londo. I get my curse cured. I can't hit ghosts anymore. And I'm just so confused. And I just run out of there as fast as I can. And then, like, I think it was like hours later, I found the item that they kept dropping was transient curse. And then I put it all together. You can only hit ghosts if you're cursed. So if you're flat out actually cursed, you can hit them. If you have the transient curse, which is temporary, you can hit them. And it gives you the ability of a curse to hit somebody, but not the half health. And it's also interesting to note that the ghosts are really only in that area where you would go to get cured of a curse. So I just, it all just connected and it blew my mind. I was so happy after
it's
that.
Like God, it's like, God damn it, Miyazaki.
You did it. You did it, you fool.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like it's kind of like the same concept in the earlier, well, in some of the, actually, I don't know which Elder Scrolls games do this. I know Morrowind does it. And I think Oblivion does this as well, where you can only hit ghosts if you have an enchanted weapon, like you can't hit, or a silver weapon.
Yeah,
you can't hit it like with like a regular steel sword. But if you put like, even if you just put like a drain stamina or something like that, like it just has to be enchanted with literally anything, and you can hit ghosts with it. It's one of those, it's those things that like everything clicks is why the Dark Souls games are so good.
There's
like
a very solid internal logic.
Yeah, so your experience was very much kind of really different than mine. You played it first through and you're like, I'm not going to look anything up, blah, blah, blah. Well, I got the game on Xbox 360 in freshman year of college. And I played it. Couldn't get past the Berg. I couldn't get past the first boss of the Taurus Demon. Well, quote unquote, first boss. It's the second boss, or depending on what direction you go.
Second one, if you're going the typical way.
Yeah, the second recommended boss. So, I put it down for years, for like 3 years, maybe. No, probably about 2 years. Then picked it up on Steam, and was just like, I'm gonna play this game. I'm gonna beat it. I'm gonna be as hands off as I can, but if I get stuck and I need help, I'm gonna do that. So yeah, I mean, I use a guide for everything, not for everything, but for a good bit, just to like help with like just tricksy areas that I'm like, what do I have to do here? What's going on?
Yeah, it like, can be very obtuse at times where you like getting to the DLC, for example. It's like you can't figure that out without looking it up.
Yeah. Like I remember probably the most like profound parts of playing the game for me is Anne Orlando. Always. Yeah. Every single time. The rafters, traversing the rafters, I've gotten really good at it now. But it sucks whenever those painting guardians gets in your way and makes you fall, and then you're just like, oh, you gotta take a breath, and then you get past that, and then you have to immediately get past the archers.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, the archers. Not too long after.
I had to look up how to get past the archers because I'm like, he's in my way. He won't move. I can't kill him. The other one keeps shooting me. What is going on? And they're just like, okay, yeah, you can like trick them this way in order to get out. The archers.
Yeah,
I will always remember the archers. Always.
Yeah, I think everyone will.
Yeah, I certainly did. Yeah.
But yeah, man. Dark Souls, such a it's one that I'll go back to every now and then. And I'll be like, okay, I'm gonna do this kind of run because it's really versatile. I haven't used a lot of magic. I usually use like heavy weapon, like a Zweihänder or like the Uchi or something like that. But it's really interesting in all the builds that you can do.
Yeah, there's a very large build diversity, and I'll probably bring up build diversity a few more times as we go through the series. But this has a pretty solid foundation of build diversity. It's not wildly different, but there are different numbery sort of nerdy things that you can get into, like, oh, am I gonna build strength? Or am I going to say screw strength? I'm going to enchant my thing raw so that it has high base damage and like no strength scaling. Yeah. Don't even worry about strength. Like things like that are super interesting. And there's a lot of, it's hard to figure out too. Like even if you look it up, some of it's hard to understand.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Any other comments that we want to talk about Dark Souls?
I have a couple impressions, you know, cause I haven't gone into it a whole lot, but like I've been taking some notes, just remembering some stuff about it. I mean, for me, because we were talking about when you talked about the change to Estus flasks. For me, that change for games like this incentivizes collectibles, because you don't have to upgrade your Estus flask. But like knowing the risks that you take with not going through those different like side quests or the progression of those things or anything like that to level up something like that, like all those collectibles and whatnot. There's not many. I think it's like maybe just Estus flask, but even then, like something like that is usually completely optional helps your gameplay so much. I love that it incentivized like collectibles and going out of your way to do these important side quests for something or another.
Yeah, and that brings up kind of the important, like a lot of people say that Dark Souls has a built-in difficulty setting. It's like, okay, you pick cleric if you want easy mode, and you maybe you pick pyromancer if you want easy mode, but then like the harder ones are like thief or sorcerer and things like that,
right.
And like getting certain things and doing certain things, it handles its own difficulty in an interesting way. Like you can kind of work your way up to be an unstoppable badass even in a game as hard as Dark Souls.
Yeah, and I think that like creativity in a game that like doesn't punish creativity, but it offers like extra challenges, right? Like it makes like you were saying, what it does, it makes the game so much more organic, and figuratively, yes, but also literally, like nothing ever stops in the game, right? Like it's all one big map, and for me, that blew my mind. That like
no loading, like the only time you have a loading screen is whenever you warp. That is it. Like that is one of the things that blew my mind. Like I didn't think about it till way later, but I'm like, oh yeah, there are no loading screens. What?
The game is one massive dungeon, in my opinion, and I think that maybe the only opposition to that is that you literally go through like a D&D style dungeon, right? Like Sif's Fortress to me was very much like a class. Sen's Fortress. That's right. That being like such a callback for me personally to like standard like D&D like winding pathways and stairways and traps and boulders,
detect and traps,
yeah.
But what's so interesting is that Sin's Fortress, most people don't see like 60% of it. Like it's so vast and so much that you can explore. But if you're just trying to get through it, you're only going to see about 30 to 40% of the whole thing.
That's right.
Like there's the whole pit at the bottom where you had to fight two Titanite demons. There's, you can go kill the two giants. You can kill the one that's, three giants. You can go kill the one that's at the front that opens the gate, which I've never done. You can kill the one that's dropping the balls into the fortress. You can kill the one that's throwing them at you as you're fighting the Iron Golem. Like you can kill them. There's a merchant there. There's one of the snake people that you have to go kill to get a key for a shortcut. Like
there's so much
there, and it's so jam-packed with just stuff in such a small little thing.
Yeah, and that's why I think I do have like maybe like one or two more points. Talking about how like the end game might feel linear, I've only reached end game like maybe twice, because my only counter argument for that is just that, like, because the whole map feels like one organic dungeon that you could just like go all sorts of ins and outs in however way you want. Like that, the way that most of the game progresses just blows me away. That there's so much choice, but they don't even give you that choice. You just, it's up to you to be like, am I going to go to like, you know, one area versus another, or like, did I even know that this area existed before? You know,
exactly. Yeah. I think like on the point of like the linearity towards like the last act, you know, mm-hmm. It's like, you know, the map has to end somewhere. Like, right. You can't just have a spiral staircase of a map that, like, everywhere goes everywhere. It has to, you have to have somewhere to go.
Yeah.
And design-wise, it's like, we can't have, especially for such important bosses, in-game bosses, that's yeah. like, here's five different ways you can get here. It's like no, like, realistically, we have to say, here's the path you need to go to get to this boss.
Yeah, I don't necessarily think it's like a very poor design. I just, it is the reality, and it is a critique you can make.
You don't want to beat the game on accident, you know? Like, you want that end game to be gratifying, and that's where I appreciate it there. But yeah.
Yeah. Do you have one more point or what?
I think just I had a brief note that like grinding only gets you so far because of weapon progression and because
get good.
Of
yeah
yeah
get you good. Eventually have like, to get
yeah.
good
yeah, yeah. The whole motto of Dark Souls, or at least the Dark Souls community, not the whole motto of Dark Souls is prepare to die, but the Dark Souls like community is get good. Like, you're, it doesn't matter, you can set up all of these different things to help you. I don't know what I'm trying to say. All these different things that allow you to get through the game easier. But until you actually learn the game, learn mechanics, stop using your shield so much, start rolling. I mean, that's really the majority of the game, is stop using your shield, start rolling, because iframes are insane. Mm-hmm. Until you learn that, and until you learn how to parry and quit being a casual, you're not gonna have a peak Dark Souls experience.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is that everything?
For Dark Souls 1, like I think that we just about covered all of Dark Souls 1
there. Let's talk about 5-10 minutes about Dark Souls 2, and we'll move into Dark Souls 3. Which really, I just kind of want to talk about the changes between Dark Souls and Dark Souls 3, not necessarily too much about it. It's all kind of the same, but there's some interesting differences.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Dark Souls 2. So for the second game, you know, we said that Miyazaki, you know, was the kind of like the chief architect behind Demon's Souls and Dark Souls. Well, for Dark Souls 2, he moved to more of a supervisor role. And he had two other employees, I forget their names, that moved into the director and co-director role. And actually, funny enough, Dark Souls 2 is the highest rated Soulsborne game.
Really?
On what?
On like Metacritic and IGN and Polygon. But all right, so like Demon's Souls, I think, got like a, like maybe like an 88 or 89 out of 100. Dark Souls, I think, was like 87, 88. Dark Souls 3 was like a 90 or something. Like, Bloodborne was like a 90. Sekiro was like a 90. I think Dark Souls 2 was like a 91 or 92.
Wow.
It was like, it's the highest rated Dark Souls game. But it's funny that like a lot of critics criticize the game for it being difficult for difficulty's sake. Like kind of missing the whole point of what made Dark Souls Dark Souls. It's because a lot of people say like, oh yeah, this is such a, you know, really in the spirit of Dark Souls, the world's interconnected, the story's really well told. The weapons and combat feels good. First of all, combat, that's a lie. I hate combat in this game so much. I feel like have you ever had to fight in your dreams? it feels like you're fighting underwater or you're fighting with weights on. That's how I feel like Dark Souls 2 is. I feel like anytime I roll, I press the roll button and it takes like half a second for me to roll, and it feels like it takes 2 seconds for me to actually roll, and it feels like it takes like another second for me to stand up, and then it takes another second for it to like be ready to take another input. It feels like there's no weight behind my weapons. Mm-hmm. I just feel like I'm so slow. Like the motion in it is not fluid at all. I'm in molasses while I'm fighting. I hate this goddamn game.
Yeah, we had the same experience, you and I. Like, we've talked about it before, but both of us have gotten, I don't know, maybe 45 minutes to an hour into the game and said, nope.
Let me actually look on Steam right now. I have, where is it at? Dark Souls 2. I have 9 hours on Dark Souls 2 and 51 minutes on Scholar of the First Sin. I hate this game. I don't want to, like... If we're done talking about it, we're done talking about it.
Yeah. I will say...
Dark Souls 1, 153 hours. Dark Souls 2, 95 minutes.
Yeah, wow. Dark Souls 1, 159 hours. Yeah.
See, my quick 2 cents. Dark Souls 1, I have 109 hours in. Dark Souls 2, 73 hours. I almost played that game to completion. And
jeez.
Oh, yeah. And I see, because the thing is, like, atmospheric-wise,
That was your first Dark Souls game, wasn't it?
That was. And then I went back and played Dark Souls 1.
I can see why.
You know, so as my first Dark Souls that I played, I liked it. But when I got to, like, maybe, like, one or two certain, like, choke points, I was like, this, honestly, I can't do it. And so, like, so it was exactly what you were talking about. Like, action-wise... It wasn't thoughtful enough for me to.
And it was and a big thing was like enemy placements. Like they would put you in a room and then of the is in there, and not like in Dark Souls would do that. They would put four just like the hollow grunts. I don't know what they call them, but like the really weak enemies that you can kill in one hit. They'd put like 10 of them in a room with you.
Yeah,
Dark Souls 2 would put like. Five of like tough enemies, and they're with you. And then you can't move. So like most of my time spent playing, I'm sitting there trying to run, avoid combat at all cost, just to get to the next part because like I haven't seen past the dock, the underground shipyard area. Mm. I don't know what's past that. I don't really care at this point.
It's kind
But what I was saying was the whole thing like. Whenever people saying like it's difficult for difficulty's sake, a lot of the critics who came from Dark Souls highly rated it. People who Dark Souls 2 was their first introduction, that's who like would give it like a 5 out of 10 or a 7 out of 10 and say like the game just it wants to be difficult, but it just wants to be difficult. It doesn't want to be challenging. It just wants to be hard. You know, like it just wants you to die and to laugh at you.
Yeah.
So that's Dark Souls 2. Fuck that game. So let's move into the most recent release of the Dark Souls series, Dark Souls 3, released in 2016. I actually started development before the release of Dark Souls 2 and alongside Bloodborne, which we'll talk about Bloodborne next episode. And with Dark Souls 3, we had Miyazaki back in the saddle as the director of the game, head of the game. And reviews, I mean, like, yeah, it was like 89 out of 100 score. People just love this game. The Dark Souls series in general, I think all the games were like 89 up. I think Dark Souls was like an 88, which it's funny that Dark Souls was like the lowest rated of the Soulsborne series, and Dark Souls 2 was the highest. I don't know. I thought that was funny.
That's crazy to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. But some changes, like, you know, we had, you know, they kind of brought back the hub world as far as having to go somewhere to level up and and go somewhere where all your NPCs gather, and you have to warp out of it. But this is actually, a lot of people criticize this game for being the most linear out of all of them. Which I would agree. It is very much
it's
like
it's pretty linear.
There is no, you can't. It's hard to go complete this part of the game before you go complete this part of the game. Now, granted, yeah, there are some bosses that are in the earlier areas that you can't. You could fight them. You will die, like Dancer. You will die. You will die. You will die. It would probably take you an hour to actually beat it without dying in one shot. So it's kind of like, it's almost gated to where you're not supposed to go that way. Because if you do go that way, you will have the toughest of times trying to get through that whole area. I enjoy combat in this game. This is my favorite game when it comes to combat.
Agreed.
I find it way more fluid. I find the hitboxes to be really satisfying. I find the storytelling in this game to be way more coherent than in Dark Souls 1. It's really easy to follow, but also it's a very it's very rehashed. And you can especially see that in the final DLC. Was it
Ring City?
Ring City, where it's kind of like here's a culmination of Dark Souls 1 and 2. It brings you through a lot of the older areas of Dark Souls 1 and 2.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the bosses are callbacks in Dark Souls 3 in general. A lot of the bosses are callbacks, and because you have your Dragon Slayer armor, which is a callback to Ornstein.
Yeah.
And I really enjoyed this game. I feel like it's, being a veteran, it's a little bit easier than Dark Souls 1. I don't know.
Well, I would agree with that.
I'll say, I mean,
mostly.
Being not very good at Dark Souls, it was a little rougher for me. But I will say, I do agree. Like, Dark Souls 3 is my favorite amongst the three.
Now, it does have some of the hardest boss fights.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up.
It has some of the hardest boss fights, but it is, I feel like, an easier game in general.
Yeah. For me, I loved, there were two things that I loved about it. They gave, for me personally, I got a sense of, like, a bigger sense of, like, well, these odds are just simply impossible. But as well as, like, agency as a player character. For me, in Dark Souls 3, I felt like I had more creativity to find the best strategy to win against those seemingly sort of impossible odds, right? Like, more so than Dark Souls. Not to say that, you know, Dark Souls has its own special place as being extremely, you know, difficult, but also creative. I just felt like I had a little bit more agency in Dark Souls 3. But more so, I loved the attention to detail was so specific that if you didn't look at around a corner properly, right, like you could miss something not important. It's more like a tangential sort of like quest line, like a side story, but like still stuff that really develops and world builds that game.
The NPC quests are way more accessible in Dark Souls 3, but also you can easily miss one section of the NPC quest and just lose out on it. I think the only one that I've actually followed through completely, I've followed through on Sigurd. Or is it Sigurd or is it Sig?
Sigmund, maybe?
Or is it Sigmeier? one of the Katarina, one of the Onion Knights, whichever Onion Knight is in Dark Souls 3. I think I've completed. I saw that one to completion, and I saw Henri, which Henri is probably the easiest NPC quest line to follow, and to make sure that you get it right. There's one that I've never been able to figure out on my own how to do. It's the chick that's in white.
She teaches you the gesture and she's just kind of there.
Yeah, and if you join the fingers of Rosaria, she doesn't like you at all.
Yeah, I remember knowing the solution at one point, but it was told to me. I never figured it out myself.
Yeah. But yeah, I really like the NPC quest in Dark Souls 3 as far as ease of access and how well you can follow them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have like a couple points. Like, okay, so you've brought up the kind of NPC stuff. I like, okay, so the compare and contrast for me between 1 and 3 is the story that happens directly to the player in 3 is more interesting than in 1.
Yes.
However, yes. The world in 1, at least to me, is far more interesting and makes much more sense to me. It's more connected and things kind of complement each other more in the first one.
It feels, in Dark Souls 1, it feels more like a world that's gone to shit. In Dark Souls 3, it feels like a world that's like planar drifting, like astral drifting, like where yeah. you're in one world and then you're in another world. And it feels like yeah. it doesn't really feel like that. There's a lot of things that are keeping the worlds connected. It feels like you're journeying to four different worlds. Yeah. So yeah, because like in Dark Souls, it feels like here is your standard fantasy RPG world. The only thing that's different is that you have this undead curse, and this undead curse works really weird, and you also have these living gods that you can, I mean, you're going to go kill, you're killing the living yeah. gods of the world, mm-hmm. and you're trying to, you know, either stop this Age of Fire or continue it. And then like you get into Dark Souls 3 and it's like that theme is really watered down. They up that theme of cycles mm-hmm. to the point that it's like, okay, we get it. This world's in cycles. Cause you had Yorm, who was a Lord of Cinder. You had, the Aldrich who consumed the Lord of Cinder. Aldrich was the Lord of Cinder. Mm-hmm. Who else is there? Anyways, but like you have like these people, and it's like okay, well, it was passed down, and like this person took it, and this person took it, or
yeah.
or like they all abandoned the post or something like that, and it's like
there's a lot of like returning elements.
Yeah, it's a really watered down Dark Souls 1 story, but it's much easier to follow, and like a lot of the background lore is much easier to get into.
Yeah, and I think I want to also note, I mean, gameplay wise, I like Dark Souls 3 more than 1, but I love the thematic approach of Dark Souls 1 more than Dark Souls 3.
Yeah. Yeah.
For sure.
Dark Souls 1 has an atmosphere that Dark Souls 3 does not match. Mm-hmm. But I still love both games
yeah.
for different reasons. The multiplayer, let's talk about the multiplayer in Dark Souls 3.
Oh man.
I love it. I kind of joined Dark Souls 1 in the ass end of when people were playing multiplayer, so I didn't really get to enjoy it that much. But Dark Souls 3 played in the heyday of it, and you obviously had your arenas as well. I've never really done arena play, but that was something that was introduced in the DLC of Dark Souls 1, but really capitalized on Dark Souls 3.
Yeah,
you have your covenants. You have your drive finger, and you can get an extra person to summon, but then you can also get an extra person that can invade you. So you can have two people summoned and two people invade you. Mm-hmm. That turns into chaos because especially yeah, depending yeah. on what covenant the invader is, you're either friends or you're enemies as well.
Yeah,
like
for
you
sure.
can because you can kill the invader and get a specific reward and deny them whatever reward they were going to get, because if you're two different covenants, you're not going to get your reward if the host dies. You mm-hmm. have to kill the host if y'all aren't the same covenant.
Yeah. And I love the risks that we took when we decided to do like Dried Finger multiplayer, like have like one or two more people on board. So it's like it's the four of us, and we know that the road is going to be even tougher, but it's like, as a player character, we have those choices to say, you know, let's roll the dice and see whether or not the game is going to get a lot more harder than it already is or not. And I loved that about
yeah.
it.
Yeah, you can make the game as hard or as easy as you want.
by default, right? Because like you don't change that difficulty setting in your settings, right? Like, you know,
yeah, it's mechanical. The game just do things in the game.
It just gets organically harder, and I loved that.
So, were there some more topics, some more things that you want to bring up, Kevin?
Yeah. So for me, I've actually I went back to play Dark Souls 3 somewhat recently, a couple weeks ago, and I don't know. I didn't feel as in love with it. I felt like it has incredible build diversity and it has all this stuff that makes it sort of, you know, it makes it more of a complex fighter than an adventure, right? So I kind of came to the opinion that I feel like the combat is too flashy. I have written here, it's a little too anime, because you can literally dual wield great swords and shoot fire from them.
Exactly. Have you seen?
It's ridiculous.
And really that like anime shit comes from, it mainly comes from like the Ring City DLC. Cause you have, you have the dual, great swords, and then you have that, that blue dagger. That's almost like a, it's like a baton almost like, and like you just sit here and you do like Sailor Moon twirls and like destroy people with it. And it like the combat is a lot more flashy, has a lot more pizzazz in it. And especially like the weapon arts bring a lot of that into it, which I am not a fan of the weapon arts. That is something that I would like to see disappear if they do another Dark Souls entry. I would like to get away from the weapon art part. I wouldn't mind I don't mind special attacks, but like, because like if like, because what was it, the was it Abyss Watcher?
The Watchers of the Abyss.
The Watchers of the Abyss sword, whichever thing that is. It's not the Artorias great sword. But like where it gave you that parrying dagger and like
it's weapon art thing was great sword.
It's weapon art thing was where you like just slide all over the floor.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, all right, what are we doing here?
exactly.
I wish it would kind of go back to that, like, you know, we're gonna plan our swings, we're gonna bait each other into attacking rather than just like, here's this super OP weapon art that I have, and if you don't know how to dodge it, you're fucked. Like, I'd like to get away from that style of combat and more back into
just into like just consciousness of like of and like mindfulness in your fighting, right?
Yeah,
like it's not a button pressing simulator. Like you have to think about your combat.
Yeah. Or like if you have this heavy weapon and you swing at me and I'm able to easily dodge it, you're not going to have time with my short sword to like be able to counter and parry. Like I'm going to get two hits on you. And if you swing like that again, I'm going to get two more hits on you.
Right.
And you're going to have to heal, and I'm just going to whittle you down like this. But if I mess up and I misstep and you hit me with that great sword, you're probably going to one-shot me. So I have to also be careful. Like, and I like how some weapons are like super heavy and you can't parry them. I like weapons like that. I wish they would kind of introduce more, because it's like, here's this heavy ass weapon that I have and you're going to easily parry it off with like a buckler or your hand. Mm-hmm. Like I wish they would kind of play more into like girth of weapons.
It makes it more of a rock paper scissors thing, it's like, where it's like parrying works for this and blocking works for this and rolling works for this.
I'm gonna swing this big swinging hammer at you. You can't block it. All you can do is dodge it. So you better dodge it, backstep it, something. Because if this hits you, it's flattening you. I wish it would go back more to that style.
Yeah, and even if it misses you, you can't poise through it.
Because there's a lot of like heavy weapons where it's like, oh, that can be parried. Oh, that can't be parried. Okay, where's the consistency? Like, because I know that I think the ultra great swords can't be parried.
Yeah, something like that.
But I don't know. But we're rolling on hour and 10. Final thoughts, Dark Souls 3?
I had two questions. One of them we kind of already answered, and it was whether or not Dark Souls 3 was held up as a quote unquote sequel to Dark Souls 1. And I think that we sort of agreed, like, gameplay wise, there's some points of it that are good, but some things that they really need to sort of review. But story-wise, I think that we can agree that Dark Souls 1 was a little... They have their pros and cons.
Dark Souls 3 was very much a retell. Like, that's what a lot of people will complain about, was like, there's not a lot of new unique ideas in Dark Souls 3. It borrowed a lot from Dark Souls, and especially Ring City DLC was basically just fan service all throughout. But I feel like there's a lot of unique story elements in it anyways. It's a weird sequel. Dark Souls 2 was a wholly new story, but a lot of people almost like treat it like, because it was so different, it almost had nothing to do with like Dark Souls. People treat it like, I've read that people treat it as like a dreamscape almost.
Like an
alternate universe. Whereas like Dark Souls 3 is this weird. I don't like that it's like they took that cyclical idea and, you know, put it to 11. Was like, okay.
I'm a slut for cyclical storytelling, right? But like the problem is that if you continue that cycle explicitly and continuously for a long period of time, it loses its magic, right? Like some of the ideas of like old like Celtic cyclical storytelling, the point was that it was so magical and so invigorating that when it came down to that return to the original, to the origin of the story, and you just sort of re-experience it again, it's supposed to retain that same magic, right? And I think that Dark Souls 3 tried to do that a little bit, but sort of missed that mark.
I feel like it hit that mark too well, like as far as like because like with the Soul Ascender, you have three outcomes. There's one outcome that I like the most. Your first two outcomes is that you do the same thing that you did in Dark Souls 1, which like turns it into these are kind of non-secular endings. If either of these endings are canon, okay, here's Dark Souls 4. But the last ending where you basically quote unquote end the cycle of fire and darkness, it should be the ending that everyone strives for. If you haven't gotten that ending,
and it's so hard to get too.
Yeah, and it's really confusing to get, but I feel like that is the actual canon ending, because that leads to, because if you take that ending and you say, okay, we're making another Dark Souls game, where do we go with it? What do we do at that point? But if you take one of the like Rekindle the Flame or Don't Rekindle the Flame, okay, then here's Dark Souls 4. Do the same thing again. We're in another age of someone has to either, you know, usurp the fire or whatever. But if you take that third ending, Dark Souls go?
Yeah,
you know,
I'll amend my statement. I think it's more fair to say that they sort of hit that mark a little too well.
Like I said, it's a very much a rehash. That's kind of how I feel about it. It's very much a rehash of Dark Souls. And there's not too many new themes going on.
Yeah, and because I know that we're sort of running out to our sort of closing remarks. With that, just to sort of backtrack from like storytelling and thematics, what were y'all's favorite builds in Dark Souls 1 and 3?
Always a knight.
Oh, Dark Souls.
Always
Dark Souls
a heavy
1.
Ass knight.
Dark Souls 1 has to be either Uchi Katana, naked Uchi Katana, or heavy armor Zweihänder. Like those two are my favorite builds.
Yeah,
I'm just always a big swinging dude.
Big swinging boy, yeah.
And then
that's what I do.
And in Dark Souls 3 was my favorite. I don't know. I don't know what my favorite is in Dark Souls 3. I think the Hollowed Greatsword.
Yeah, yeah.
I really like that one. That one's really good.
Mm-hmm. I because the most recent time I played Dark Souls 1, it was when I finally actually got to the ending of the game. Like I finally got to Lord Gwyn, right? And like that whole progression was with Naked Chaos Flamberge, or no, it was a Chaos Wyhander. So like that, like just ridiculousness of being like some like barbarian rage Zweihander that like deals so much like damage and stuff like that. That was just kind of fun for me to just to be like. To take on the Dark Souls approach in a little bit more of a, not a silly way, but like in a way that just kind of like it kind of takes you a little bit aback from it.
A non-conventional method.
That's right, a non-conventional. However, my favorite, and I do kind of agree with Kevin, like night wise, Dark Souls 3, my favorite was just a one-handed sword, a shield, and plate armor was and is my favorite build, because to me it's as medieval as it gets.
With the whole
ins and outs of the way that Dark Souls works, it's all of those different medieval themes. I loved just being a standard, just average sword and shield knight that tries to dodge roll, right?
Like,
yeah, I did a soul level 1 run once in Dark Souls 1 with I did spear and shield. I had two spears. I had one that did fire and one that did lightning. Between the two, I could manage generally everything, and it just felt really authentic. Other than shooting lightning out of my spear, it felt really like genuine. Like I'm hiding behind my shield, waiting for my right time. I step to the side and I give him a little stab, right? Yeah. It just felt good, like I'm a knight.
Sure.
let's move to the outro.
All right,
so I have a surprise outro for y'all. I know we discussed something else before, but I figured this would be fun to do. So if Tombstone Crew were to make a game, a video game, what would the name of the video game be? We'll start with Kevin.
Ooh, you put me on the spot. Let's see. Tombstone video game that we're making. All right, well, it's definitely going to be cooperative to some extent and probably also competitive. So maybe somewhat like the Dark Souls. It would definitely be very fantasy-esque because we're all kind of into that. Like Elden something. Elden...
Are you just gonna say Elden Rings?
No.
You just gonna steal it?
I didn't even know that was a game. Return to Elden. There we go.
Return to Elden.
Yeah. Right.
What about you, Dominic?
Fire and Stone, and it could be. It would be either.
Just give it a name.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So Fire and Stone would be our Tombstone. Right. Tombstone game.
Fire and Stone.
That's good.
You? All right, Zach.
I don't really know. To me, it would depend on what type of game it was.
Go ahead and start thinking of what the game would be.
I feel like it would just be some like made up name that has no other meaning.
Just some like we just made it off the top of our heads. So let's just call it this.
Yeah,
like not too Solaxis.
Yeah, something like that. It would just be some random made up word.
That's cool. All right. So that's that's episode 1 of our Soulsborne episode. We'll be back next week with Bloodborne, and Sekiro shouldn't run this long. We're running on an hour and 20 on this one. We'll see you next week for the finishing up Soulsborne. Goodbye, everyone.
Goodbye.
Gooby.
Goodbye.